Hi, everybody. Welcome to Beyond Consulting. I am Olivia Hannanen, Engagement Manager with ECA Partners, and I'm here with a co-host, Jason Blonstein, one of the Managing Directors at ECA. Beyond Consulting is the only podcast focused on your career, health, and wealth after consulting. Jason, thank you for that. We are here with a fantastic guest. Rahul Mehta is currently Chief Strategy Officer at TaRChen International. We're going to be talking a lot more about what he's up to there and what TaRChen do. But prior to a career in investment banking, Rahul spent some time at EY. Rahul, thank you so much for taking time to join us. How's it going?
Hi, Liv. Thank you for having me. It's going great. It's another Wednesday afternoon. Busy here at work and happy to be here with you.
Fantastic. So I think before we really dive into what you did as a consultant, what you got out of it, could you just set the stage for us a little bit? Maybe take a minute or two to introduce yourself, talk about your road up to consulting and why you found it an appealing route to go down earlier on in your career.
Sure. So Liv, I started out as an accountant pretty early on in my career. I decided to pursue chartered accountancy, which is similar to the certified public accountant accreditation here in the US. I decided to do that concurrently with my college. And so I landed up getting certified and accredited at the age of 21. So one of the youngest chartered accountants in the country. And this was in India. I decided to join Arthur Andersen at the time, which then eventually became Ernst & Young in the country. Arthur Andersen at the time was a place where most of the brightest minds would go if you were interested in a career in broadly the commerce world. I was in Arthur Andersen / EY for a total of 6 years in the tax and business advisory practice. The tax and advisory practice was essentially dealing with direct taxes, indirect taxes, and some of the business issues that would come out of it. Loved the people, loved the work ethic, loved the exposure that it gave to clients, mostly multinational and global organizations. Loved the professional approach towards work and, you know, certainly a phenomenal experience early on in my career. And it certainly shaped me as a professional. And having done that for about 6 years in various roles and capacities, I was actually, you know, not only did I like the exposure, I turned out I was actually good at it. And I got the double promotion, was put on an accelerated path to becoming a partner. And then I just decided one day that I wanted more challenges. I wanted to do more than just tax and business advisory. I wanted to get exposure to the broader business world. So I packed my bags, came to New York City, and decided to pursue my MBA here in the city. So I went to NYU Stern, got exposure to most things that you would expect from New York City, which is finance and more finance. And in the process, I decided that I would channel my career into investment banking, which felt like I was trained to do. There was the accounting background and the ability to understand financial statements, but then also the creativity aspect to it. This was, you know, many years ago, back in the day when Lehman Brothers was still alive and also a very well-regarded M&A shop. So I decided to join Lehman Brothers at the time. I was in the industrials practice, specializing in mergers and acquisitions. And that was a fantastic journey in the industrials world. One of the primary reasons for joining investment banking was the philosophy that whatever skill sets I learned on the job are portable, and I could take those classic EBIT-based finance skills on over to venture capital or private equity or even industry. Before I knew it, 10 years had passed. Lehman had become Barclays, and I was still there. And I continued to question myself as I went from associate to vice president to senior vice president or director. Is my role really what I wanted to be long-term, and is this something that I wanted to continue doing over a period of time? All the while, I thought of it as being a 3 to 5 year stint. And here I am 10 years on, still doing phenomenal stuff at the investment banking world. But I just felt the need that I needed to shape something and be part of something bigger where I could be more involved with a particular business or a particular set of people. And thus I embarked on a journey there. I went through Arconic for 2 years in the corporate development and strategy. There, I did work on the M&A side, but also from a strategic standpoint, how do we want to position ourselves with investors and what is the right portfolio mix for the company as we continue to evolve? In that process, I landed up selling a business to a company called Tachen. And shortly after closing that transaction, I joined Tachen. So it's been about 4 years since I've been here. I'm the chief strategy officer. The role is very broad, but it's certainly very different from, you know, the four different gigs that I had previously. And there are many exciting things to come.
Fantastic stuff, Rahul. Thanks so much for that. I've got a few follow-up questions. I'm going to address them, I think, chronologically. So first question around your exit from consulting. Was it just kind of one day you were like, all right, it's time. I know that I have gotten everything I'm going to get out of this and it's time to make the move. Or was that more of kind of a gradual process? I know I can barely remember what I did last week. So asking you about something a long time ago is not fair. But if you can recall anything about that thought process, you know, was it an easy decision? Was it a tough one as you decided to go and get your MBA instead?
Yeah, of course. Liv, I think it's actually a combination of multiple things. The decision ultimately was, I just made the decision one day to do it, but there was always this lingering thought in the back of my mind. You know, as consultants and maybe, you know, later on as bankers, these are really apprenticeship businesses, right? And so when you think about where you are in the organization and where some of the other senior people are, you keep asking yourself, is that the person I want to be? And as I moved from staff accountant to senior to manager in the 6 years that I was a consultant, there was always this thing in my head, two things. Firstly, from a professional standpoint, where do I want to focus? And I think the answer was very loud and clear to me, which is I don't really want to be a technician. I don't want to be a person who's specializing in one particular aspect of business, which in my case happened to be tax. And then the second is, what kind of exposure am I getting as I'm doing my job? Am I feeling excited about it? Or am I feeling like this is great? And is this just a way to make ends meet for myself further down the road? So both those decisions were always there at the back of my mind. And if you throw in another layer on it, that I always wanted to do my MBA, I always wanted to go live on Bleecker Street in New York City, listening to Simon and Garfunkel growing up. And so I just said one day, I just got to take the plunge. I just got to go. And what better way to do it than just go to New York City where all the action is. So I think it was a combination of professional choices as well as where I was personally and what I wanted to do with my life, which is a little bit of a, you know, let's take that leap.
Yeah. Awesome. And was the plan when you exited your MBA always investment banking, or did you have a few options on the table?
Now, when I give my story, I always say investment banking was what I was born to do. And that's why, you know, all the decisions were catered toward that. The truth be told, I think when we get into business school, we are sucked into the process. And the process often sort of shapes your thinking. And I have to be honest here that when I went to business school, I actually really didn't know what I wanted to do. And I was hoping to get exposure to various companies on campus and talk to several people and do what MBA is advertised to do, which is help you discover the world out there.
Yeah.
In reality, when I first came into business school, I found the pace to be just so much different from what I expected. It wasn't the, oh, let's go get some happy hour drinks with people and explore. Of course, there was that, but there was also, let's get your act together. Your resume had to be polished up on day one. And before I knew it, it was October, November of the first semester. And, you know, an overwhelming majority of my peers had already figured out what they want to do. And if you wanted to be successful coming out of business school, you needed a summer program. And if you needed to have the summer internship program, you need to know what you want to do and be prepared for the interviews by, of course, January, which means that as part of a process, you need to go through informationals, which is a very specific investment banking process in business school, very early on, which is in October, November of that semester. So I got sucked into that process. And while I had a couple of different choices, I started to realize that investment banking is not what I first expected it to be. It's actually more playing to my core strengths. as I mentioned before, coming in as an accountant, it's a language that I know how to speak. And it's a client service industry. And of course, there's that fast-paced environment of investment banking that appealed to me. And as I met more and more people in banking, I started to realize I actually know people in banking, and I know people who are in banks that I want to actually target. And that set about a chain reaction of events, which led me to ultimately go into investment banking. And I was fortunate enough to get multiple offers. And so that sealed the deal for me, that the fact that not only I want to be in banking, but they actually want me here. So there must be a good match.
Yeah. And what kept you in banking? You said that you ended up more longer than you anticipated. Was it that fast pace, that kind of feeling that there was a match that was kind of meant to be?
What I noticed is that 90%+ of people who are in banking thought about it as a 3 to 5 year stint.
Yeah.
There are very few people, and that's great, right? There are very few people who come in saying, I want to be a banker for life. So for those 90% of us, I think we think of it as a 3 to 5 year stint for a few reasons. One is, as I mentioned before, it's an excellent training ground. Mm-hmm. You not only learn the numbers and the math and the accounting and bringing together all the different aspects of what it takes to get a deal done, but there's also a lot of storytelling. Storytelling is fun. There's a lot of being at the forefront of innovation with respect to some of the M&A technology. And at the end of the day, at a bulge bracket bank, you're shaping the industry. You're the first person to know what's going on. You're trying to connect all the dots. You're talking to CEOs, CFOs of the biggest companies in the world. It's just a phenomenal exposure. Why do I think I was there longer than expected? I think, first of all, 3 to 5 years is a good amount of time to get that portability, right? To understand what banking is all about and to understand what does it take to get deals done and also to understand what it takes to run a business. And then let's be honest, 3 to 5 years, even coming from consulting, 3 to 5 years in banking felt like 10. So it felt like a full career in 5 years. Why did I stay on is because I continued to enjoy the work that I was doing. I like the people. I love the exposure that was giving me. The kind of conversations we were having with the C-suite, I don't think we could have that anywhere else in any type of profession. This is about what you're doing next. It's not about what you're reading in the newspapers. It's about, for example, I was in the automotive industry and I landed up leading the M&A practice in M&A at the bank. And the conversations we were having were about, you know, self-driving vehicles, about electric vehicles, way before Tesla was even, you know, in the mix. And it's so fascinating to see how those thoughts evolve amongst the leaders in the client base. And sometimes it just takes time. And where we are today is so different from where we were 10 years ago. But as I reflect on some of those conversations, it was very, very interesting. So, you know, on the one hand, while things feel like it's longer and in 3 to 5 years does feel like 10, on the other hand, time does pass by pretty quickly because you're always on the road, you're always meeting interesting people, you're always doing fun stuff, and the rewards are good. So, yes, I think I landed up staying a long time. Now, having said that, if you asked me what I would do differently, I would still say for the same amount of time because I got experiences out of the senior years in investment banking that I wouldn't have had as a junior.
It's interesting. And then that transition, I imagine that transition from investment banking into industry had to be different, right? Because you're no longer in an advisory capacity, right? You're no longer just providing guidance. So how was that transition? Were there any major hurdles that you faced, skill gaps?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because I think the first transition going from consulting to investment banking in many ways was a lot easier. I think in particular, like you said, both are advisory client servicing businesses. And so it comes with the same type of work ethic. Deadlines are sacrosanct. You think about the high level, you have to be quick understanding different businesses. You have to be able to rationalize some of the problems and issues that you see and come up with solutions. And of course, the work ethic is very similar. That said, the key difference between going from consulting to investment banking was still, to me, the biggest difference was as an accountant or as a consultant, you're thinking always bottoms up. You're thinking about, you know, you're first in search of the truth. You try to figure out what are some of the facts out there and how do you build a story around that and then get to a conclusion. In investment banking, I think you'll often hear that it's the other way around. You first want the answer, you need the conclusion, and then you craft a story around it and you hope that the facts fit within that. Right? Yeah. So that's, I say it half jokingly, but that's sort of how you want investment banking to be, because at the end of the day, as a banker, you get paid for that conclusion. You get paid for doing the deal. You don't get paid for just investing your time in it. So that's the brutal reality. I think the transition from investment banking to industry was much more of a transition. And why I say that is because as a consultant or a banker, your real value that you bring to the table, if you think about the product that you deliver that has value, it's essentially that deck that you create and it's how you deliver it, right? I'm making it very simple, but that's essentially what your value is. In industry, that's obviously not the case because you're often the recipient of that product. And what you have to deal with very often is to be able to make decisions with imperfect information, or you just don't have everything available to you. So let me give you an example. An example is, as an investment banker, you do the pitch, and of course that takes a lot of effort and takes probably, you know, a good amount of time. Once you win the mandate, if you do, you get into shaping of the transaction from a process perspective. You get into very quickly into due diligence, and then you hope that it ultimately leads to a successful transaction. Due diligence, for example, there is just viewed as process. It's viewed as where the junior guys essentially are populating data rooms and doing a coordination task and sitting up till 3 a.m, uploading documents onto the data room and looking at diligence questions and so on and so forth. So it's kind of pretty mundane. On the industry side, you can never have all the information because the seller is never going to give you everything. It's not because they don't want to. Maybe sometimes they do, but there just isn't enough time. There isn't enough context. There isn't enough resources. And so you're left with, and again, this is just an example, but you're left with a set of facts and a set of due diligence results, which are often not enough. And then you have the process of putting a box around each of those risks and saying, okay, now let's zoom out and understand, is this something still I want to do? Did my incoming thesis get verified through what I've learned? And is there still value in pursuing this transaction? And as a banker, as an accountant, as a consultant, you can make assumptions and you can deliver your product, but as an industry guy who has to live with that transaction, there are only that many assumptions that you can make. And you can get away with a mistake or two, but when you have to live with that marriage for the rest of your career in the organization, then you can't afford to do that too often.
Yeah.
So that to me, the layer of judgment that you put on top of everything that you find is certainly something was a learning experience for me. You know, consultants, bankers, accountants are constantly coming and pitching stuff and saying things, but then you can't believe everything and you have to understand and you have to read between the lines and you have to make your own decisions. So I feel that that transition is a little harder from that perspective. I think the other thing is on the softer side, I think it's important to keep in mind that the strongest skill sets that one brings to the table as a consultant and a banker is that work ethic. It's the ability to work within deadlines. It's because your work product is that deck and its delivery. Whereas in industry, you're not that important because you're coming in with those skill sets into an organization. In my case, that's manufacturing something. Or in the case of a person who's going to technology, who's, you know, obviously that company has a product. And so that's where the money is made. The money is not made by the consultant or the strategist talking about, let's do this and let's do that. Without the technicians, you're not going to make the money. In my case, in manufacturing, the biggest asset is our machinery and it's our factories and it's our assets sitting on the floor. Of course, the people are important, but without the assets, you won't generate the revenue. So I think that's something which people do need to keep in mind. I think me included, and a lot of other people come in to industry saying, hey, we've got all these skill sets, we're very smart, we can rationalize, there's a lot of low-hanging fruit, we can do this and we can do that. And that's true, but you're always dealing with a situation where there are limited resources and priorities of the company are not necessarily tailored around M&A and around strategy and consulting and some of the business processes that you bring to the table. So I think that realization, the sooner they realize that, the better it would be for them, and they will be able to tailor their expectations accordingly.
You know, one of the things that I hear from employers with transitioning consultants is pace, right? That when you're moving from, and I'm sure it's similar in the investment banking world, but in the consulting world, you know, you're paid for to hit those deadlines, right? And you're going to push all the time until you make it. That mentality doesn't always play well in the corporate world, right? Where if you push too hard, you're basically just going to burn bridges. You can't always be pushing people at that same pace. Is that something that you found? Is that something you had to learn when you transitioned into industry?
100% with you, Jason, on that. And I think that goes back to what I was saying about the expectation and realigning that, because deadlines are so important for delivery of a work product in consulting and investment banking, but it's not that important, you know, in a manufacturing or an industry context. Mm-hmm. And again, that goes back to what are the assets and what's the most important thing here. And this could get a little frustrating for people. Mm-hmm. So yes, I think that is a reality. I think you have to think about deadlines as being a little bit more squishy. It's not about 5 p.m. on a Thursday. And that has its pros and cons. I think, you know, when you zoom out and you think about what deadlines really matter, of course, if you're in a technology company that has a product launch, the deadline around that product launch is the most important thing. And if there is a initiative on the back end that deals with efficiency or process improvement, that's not necessarily in front of line. And very often it just happens that when you plan for a certain initiative within an organization, things almost never go according to plan. And there's always things that are coming in the way. And being able to navigate that, I think, is a real skill set to have. And very often you're in the middle, right? Because people who are on one end of that initiative expect that the team delivers on time. And then on the other end of the spectrum, you're dealing with people who are helping you in that initiative who have other day jobs. So it is a more difficult process. And I think what I would say is it's all about teamwork. And you just have to invest in different types of relationships when you're internally within the organization versus when you're a consultant.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
Well, I've got a couple of questions about the transition away from banking, because I feel like I've heard some people say the longer you're in, the harder it is to leave. So again, did you kind of get to a point where you knew it was time to move on and then you were just keeping your eyes open? And when Arconic came along, you were kind of ready to make that jump? Or was it more the case that Arconic kind of came at you and you were a little surprised at the opportunity and that sort of forced you to make a jump? How did that look?
It's definitely the former because, you know, as I mentioned before, most of us get into it with a 3 to 5 year stint in mind.
Yeah.
And while I enjoyed the banking experience, I always felt like I needed to be part of something a lot bigger, but I had no idea what it was. Mm-hmm. I had no idea what I wanted to do. So a combination of factors led to me moving on to industry. One is where the banking industry was at the time and where Barclays was at the time, and my relationship with Barclays. And then, of course, the opportunity had to present itself in Arconic. So there's certainly both factors at play. I would just say that it was a matter of time. I just didn't know what the right time was and where I would land.
Got it.
What was particularly appealing about that opportunity? It seems to me that it's interesting you moved from that service industry into manufacturing, where there is that tangible good, as you just mentioned, and that's kind of where the value is. It's very different. To me, it's more different than moving into software, for example, where there is obviously a product, but again, you can't. It's just something like a little bit less tangible, if that makes sense.
Yes. I mean, I think when you think about the role, I think about, well, and I'm going to contradict myself as I say this, because I think of my role as being a set of skill sets, which I can port in whatever industry, yeah, right? So I can tomorrow move into software, I could move into manufacturing or energy or what have you. On the other hand, the more time you spend in a particular industry, and I suppose the more senior you get, there is an expectation that you understand the industry because the solutions lie in understanding the nuances. And I was specializing in industrials. Industrials consists of probably a dozen verticals. One of the verticals was manufacturing of aluminum and steel products. So you think about Arconic's products that were going to aerospace, they were going into automotive, they were going into other industrial applications. These are all things that I was very familiar with. So I knew where the automotive industry was, what are some of the initiatives of the auto industry. I had a good exposure to aerospace through my work with aerospace companies. And so it was actually more natural than it appears to be from the outside, because understanding the industry is important. And you think about, you know, as an investment banker, what is it that you're really taking to that industry? You're taking not just those skill sets, but also understanding who's who in that industry. What are they trying to do? What is the strategic chessboard like? And can you anticipate the moves that are about to come by the players in the industry, understanding where the industry is headed based on some of the challenges and opportunities that lie ahead? So these kind of things, while I say that our skill sets as accountants and consultants and bankers are portable, it does take time to understand the industry. It probably takes sometimes years, sometimes, you know, good solid months. But to really understand the nuances, it takes time. So if you ask me what would be my advice to some of these consultants and accountants and investment bankers moving on to industry, I think I would tie this into the previous question that you had earlier. The earlier you make that move, the less of an expectation there is that you are an industry person, right? But the longer you take to move on, and of course, that reflects in the level that you get inserted into that organization, the more there's an expectation of you understanding what is it that we really do? How do we make money? What is the business? What's that strategic chessboard like? And are you able to understand that? And no matter what the title says, anybody at that leadership level is expected to know that, whether you're the CFO or the CSO or the CEO, and of course, the technology person and so on and so forth. You have to understand the industry.
That's a great point. That's a great point. Well, maybe talk a little bit about your industry. So talk about your current company, what your role is there, and what you guys do.
So we are a publicly traded company based out of Taiwan. We did about $3.5 billion in revenues. About 75% of those revenues were generated in the US, and that's where I focus. We do essentially distribution of specialty metals. And 4 years ago, there was an initiative to backward integrate and get from distribution to manufacturing. Now, over the last 3 to 4 decades, the business world has gone the opposite direction, right? So a lot of manufacturing companies have spun off the distribution arms, whether it's GE or, you know, you name the company. There are very few captive distribution businesses within manufacturing organizations, and that's for various reasons. So this was more of a strategic imperative based on where this particular industry was headed. And so we continue to evolve as an organization, and I spent a lot of time in that evolution of being a distribution company as well as a manufacturing company. And that has accounting implications. It has implications in the way we think about capital allocation. It has implications around what relationships we have and so on and so forth. My role is essentially based on 3 pillars. One is strategy, which includes M&A, and that comes with everything that you would expect out of it. Where are we headed as an organization? Do we grow organically? Do we grow through M&A? If it's M&A, then what are the targets out there? What's actionable? What's pricing? What's our capital structure? Where does it all fit in? So that's one pillar. The second one is operations. This was a fantastic opportunity for me to understand operations. It's a much smaller organization than Arconic or some of the other organizations that people tend to move into. And the advantage of that is, of course, everybody knows each other, which is great. We are a little bit more than 1,000 people. And it's an opportunity for me to identify opportunities, problems and opportunities, and to attack them head on. And that's what I do as an operations guy. I do quality. I do a bunch of things that I never thought I would do, you know, even 4 or 5 years ago. And then the third pillar is strategic finance. Just given my background, you know, finance is obviously one of the majors and there are Wall Street relationships. And I do leverage them when times are tough. Like March, April 2020 was a tough time. It was a tough time for all of us. And, you know, we managed to do something that turned out to be really good. So I think overall, the role has certainly evolved. I've had to be flexible, but But I've learned a lot and I continue to do so.
What would you say the kind of key measures of success that you look at for both your role and in your industry?
I think the flexibility is an important element. I think as you grow senior, and I would expect that some of the people listening to this podcast coming out from consulting or banking or accounting, going into industry, you know, the first couple of years, you're probably just learning. But as you get into a mid-level to a senior level, flexibility is an important element, because what I learned as a consultant, as a banker, as certainly the technical aspects, it has value. But, you know, at the end of the day, let's take an example. You're not doing M&A every year all the time for various reasons. As we all know, the last year and a half have been difficult from an M&A standpoint because of interest rates, because of valuations and, you know, sellers' expectations with respect to valuation. So it's been quiet. But at that time, as we move away from M&A, we have to be focusing on other initiatives, whether it's internal initiatives or it's, you know, operational things. And let's layer on top of that, that most industries tend to be cyclical. My industry is probably more cyclical than others. And so that cyclicality is another aspect which is distinct from my own skill sets. It's about where the organization is prioritizing its efforts at the moment. So my biggest advice to people would be, don't stick to what your job description says, because the role evolves over time. And that's a great thing about being in industry versus being, you know, in consulting, where, of course, your role evolves as you get more senior, but you're essentially dealing with a pool of clients, and you're always dealing with a pool of clients. It doesn't change as much as in industry. You're really evolving from perhaps, you know, in some cases, the underdog to the leader, or in some cases from, you know, a cyclical low to a cyclical high, or vice versa, which involves different skill sets coming to the table.
Great stuff, Rahul. Thank you so much. I think this has been a fantastic conversation. I think we can move towards wrapping things up. I guess any final words of wisdom that you would share with our audience, who again are likely current management consultants thinking about that next step? And I always like to ask people, do you have a book recommendation that you would like to put out there? It can be relevant to the conversation, or it can be completely irrelevant.
I think the biggest advice I would give, well, firstly, this is obviously very personal, but if I were to do anything differently, I probably wouldn't do anything differently, because I enjoyed the experience and I enjoyed every aspect of what I did. But I also wasn't very clear in my mind what I wanted to do. And if you ask me now, what do I want to do over the next 3 to 5 years, I would still be a little fuzzy on the 5-year horizon. I think I have a better sense of the 3-year horizon. But to the extent that you have an inclination to move out of consulting into industry, I would say reach out to headhunters, reach out to people in industry, talk to them, be in the know, and don't hesitate to make that move earlier on. Take a risk earlier on. And I think that's super important, because very often we get sucked into the ins and outs of the daily life of being a consultant or a banker, and you just don't have the time to interact with headhunters or interact with people from outside your world and into the industry. And I would say one of my learnings is now to just be out there, constantly network, constantly talk, because you just never know what's out there till you expose yourself and till you're, you know, in part of the conversation mix. That sounds very generic and broad, but it's really hard to do, because you have to tell yourself, oh, okay, every week I'm going to carve out an hour, even if it's a Saturday or a Sunday, or maybe 2 hours, to just reach out to X, Y, and Z, or have coffee with so-and-so person, think about who your role models are, talk to them. It's so easy to be so focused in the work that you're doing that you forget about yourself. And that's, you know, I think that would be my 2 cents of advice. I wouldn't recommend any book as much, Liv, as much as, you know, to me, I find I read The Economist a lot. I read Fortune magazine. Fortune is just great. It's so inspirational. You read about some people and what they do, and I tend to then stare at the wall and say, wow, I mean, that's just amazing how they did all the things that they did and how they evolved in their own personal and professional careers. And I find that inspirational. So to me, inspiration is the biggest motivator. And so whatever motivates you, you know, I don't have a particular book in mind.
No, I think that's great. Rahul, thank you so much for taking the time. Fantastic to chat. And thank you, everybody, for listening.
Thank you.
Thank you, Liv. Thank you, Jason.